Good evening and welcome to this Institute for Government event, which is very kindly sponsored by the British Red Cross. For those of you who don't know me, I am Joe Owen. I'm Director of Impact at the IFG. I wanted to start the event with a bit of a scene setter. More than 100,000 people are awaiting a decision on their asylum application. Downing Street is saying that this is not a problem unique to Britain, but reflecting a rise in global instability. The Home Office has said that new legislation will solve the problem, and the opposition is calling the government incompetent. That scene could well describe now, but is actually a summary from a news article in January 2000. If it had have been written in January this year, 24 years later, there might have been a few differences. The total backlog number would be pushing 120,000. It would have referenced the £8 million a day being spent on hotel accommodation, and I'm sure would have some reference to Rwanda. But many of the core problems in the asylum system today are strikingly familiar to those that we have faced before. The purpose of this event is to step back from the daily headlines on asylum policy and instead ask, why is it such a chronic policy problem in the UK? What can the government, whoever wins the next election, do to improve the system? I can speak only for myself when I say I really hope I'm not at an IFG event in 24 years' time on the same topic with the same headlines bubbling around. And that is in part because I'm sure the panel in 24 years' time will not beat the panel that we've got today. I am delighted to welcome an expert panel. To my far right, Albina Shibhamu, Ambassador for the Voices Network, a collective of refugees and people seeking asylum. To my immediate right, Sal Copley, Executive Director of Communications and External Affairs at the British Red Cross. To my immediate left, Lizzie Durden, Home Affairs and Security Journalist at The Independent. And last but...
Freelance.
And then last but by no means least, Sir Philip Rutnam, former Permanent Secretary at the Home Office. So we'll kick off with the discussion amongst the panel, but then we'll turn to questions from the floor about halfway through. I will leave plenty of time for those questions, so please do store them up as we go along. For those online, you can send your questions in via Slido and we will use them. And if anyone has more of a comment than a question, then why not tweet it with the hashtag IFG Asylum Policy. So, I'm going to start with you, Albina, if that's okay. As someone who has first-hand knowledge of the asylum system and as part of the Voices Network, what kind of experiences do people have who are seeking asylum in the UK? What works and what doesn't?
Thank you, Joe, and thanks for having me. Hi, everyone. So asylum seekers actually go through a lot of challenging experiences on a day-to-day level, and there's so many issues that have been subject to public scrutiny and interest, and these would be, I'm going to touch on the backlog, the asylum accommodation, and also, you know, the ever-changing policies, including the Rwanda scheme. So just going back to the backlog, for example, asylum seekers, you know, the average person is spending 1 to 3 years before they get the first, you know, initial decision. And these waiting times are so long. As of last year, it's funny how you mentioned the data from 20 years ago, but Home Office report on the length of times that it was taken to process asylum claims, it's over 65,000 cases were over 3 years old. And this is maybe the least. It can span years, 5 years, 10 years, 14, and believe it or not, it can be 20 years plus. And waiting for a decision and waiting in limbo for without knowing, without moving on with your life is actually very, very crippling. And I want to say at this point that much of the asylum system, asylum process is inherently undignified. So basically, asylum seekers, when they come in the country, they've got no recourse to public funds, they cannot work. So that means they're entirely dependent on the support that they get from the Home Office. The money has been historically very low, but the current standing is £49.18 per week per person. And take, for example, where I'm from Glasgow, and transport per day is £5.40. And the daily amount for one person is £7. So if I'm going to spend £5.40 on transport, that is going to leave me with just over £2 to, you know, look for food, toiletries, and my communication needs. And this basically leads me to say that most, if not all, asylum seekers are living in food poverty and digital poverty. So yeah, that's about the backlog. Just moving on to hotels, the use of hotels for asylum accommodation. I think this is actually re-traumatizing to put people in a hotel situation in an enclosed space when they are coming from a place of trauma is more traumatic to them. And the use of hotels was started first to be used just after the pandemic. And then I think the key issue here would be, you know, institutionalization. So as I just mentioned, that if you put people that are coming from trauma in a place where they're enclosed, they don't have any choice of what time to come in, what time to go out, I think it's basically debilitating for them. People in the asylum system are already frightened. They go through hard, arduous journeys to get here. They risk their lives. They lose loved ones on the way, you know, when they're traveling to get here. And they even, you know, risk going into the channels where they know that there's potential of death. But guess what? They do it anyway because they're so desperate for safety. But only to come here and they're met by such hostility, you know, fostered by the Nationality and Borders Bill. So I think, like, having to put people up in hotels and barges and former military barracks is absolutely inhumane. It's singling people out. It's segregating them from the community. And this is not great. So I also want to say for this point that as hotels are not cheap. I've been through that myself. When I lived in hotels, they were paying about £60 a night for me, and that equates to £420 in a week. And if I had £420, that would be enough to, you know, to get accommodation or a flat for a whole month. But they don't do that. That just clearly shows you that the system is made for, you know, they just want to make profits. So basically, I want to take this opportunity to maybe dispel some misconceptions when it comes to hotels. So the average person, you know, when you leave your home and you go to a hotel, you're looking for luxury, you want a holiday, or you want just to spend time away from home, and that means clean sheets, that means someone is at your beck and call, and they're giving you food. But this is hardly the case when it comes to asylum hotel accommodation. I don't know why they are called hotels, but because they're clearly not. When I was 6 months pregnant, the time that I was accommodated in these hotels, I was placed in a fourth floor and there was no lift access. I could not even walk straight in the room. I had to walk sideways because there was hardly any room between the single bed and the wall. There was no window in this place. So the food, I don't even want to talk about it. The sharing shower facilities, absolutely dire. So, you know, this is, I think the public have got a false impression when it comes to hotels. So it's just fair to say that, you know, it's even more humane to place people within the communities where they can integrate, they are not isolated, and they can easily, you know, mix in with people and not feel so isolated. Because, you know, asylum seekers, when they come here, they don't know anybody, they don't know the system. Some even don't know the language. So, which is where I feel like I can at least speak English. And then I always spare a thought for people that don't speak a word of English, because you think, how are they going to navigate the system? Their challenges must be doubly or triply, you know, what I go through. Also, fair to say that hotel accommodation is catered, so they tend to give £8 per week for people that live in hotel accommodations, which is hardly enough for anything. Going back to what I mentioned about, you know, clothes and communication needs, Wi-Fi, and all that sort. But I tend to describe hotel accommodation as Groundhog Day. Imagine, you know, waking up in the same room, and then you go down, you've got the same breakfast, you've got the same lunch, you've got the same dinner, and then you've got a curfew. Somebody tells you what time to go in and what time to go out. You go to bed and you wake up, and then you have to relive that very same day over and over and over again. So this spans from weeks, months, and even years, as I said. So this is completely inhumane. I just want to mention also that, you know, when you're dealing with people that are running away from trauma, we have to be very, very sensitive how to deal with people. It's very traumatic. It's undignified. So maybe I should just go on to suggest what would work.
That would be great.
Yes. So basically, a few years ago, I was part of a research that was co-produced by the Voices Network and the British Red Cross. And this report really just basically explored the experiences of women seeking asylum. So just going through the interviews, it was very, very clear to me, like, how much resonated with me. As I was interviewing these women, I thought, hang on a minute. I thought I was going through a tough time, but this is, you know, happening to a lot more people around me. So we should change the narrative, and things really need to change from that perspective. So on that basis, the key recommendation would be for the Home Office to have a trauma-informed asylum process and to have a gender-sensitive asylum process, because, you know, when you have people that are coming from danger and then they're being interviewed by males, they're being interviewed by people that they are not comfortable with, I don't think they are in a good stead to even say their story. So another recommendation would be for a fair and timely decisions for asylum cases, and they should be safeguarding and accountability for this as well. And then the system should also provide safe housing for people. Just going back to what I mentioned about, you know, hotel accommodation, there's so many benefits to accommodating people within the communities. You know, the sense of integration, the sense of connections, accessing support. So ostracizing asylum seekers to places like hotels, barges, and former military barracks exposes them to people that are anti-immigration, anti-asylum seekers. Take, for example, what happened a few years ago with the Napier barracks. There was a fire there. So you don't want to stigmatize people, you know, with that. And lastly, asylum seekers come in with a wealth of talents and capabilities. We've got doctors, psychologists, lawyers, you name it. So why would, limit people to the shortage occupation list if and when they can work? Number one, the asylum seekers should be allowed to work at least after 6 months, when they haven't had a response. And then they should be allowed to work in their chosen field. I think I'll stop here for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Alvina. Sal, I was going to come to you next, if that's okay. And Alvina mentioned the backlog, and obviously we know that the sort of overall asylum backlog has fallen slightly since Rishi Sunak's pledge to clear older cases by the end of 2023. But what were the big drivers of the backlog in the first place? And do you think any of the underlying causes have been addressed?
The short answer is no. But it's really hard not to listen to you, Alvina, and not to feel a real rage and shame. I think there is a fundamental problem about the absence of compassion and humanity and how we as a nation respond. We have every year more displaced people than ever before, and this is growing, and we behave as if this is something that's just happening to the UK. So the British Red Cross, and honestly, I I started 6 months ago with the Red Cross, and I couldn't be prouder to work for the same organisation which Alvina chooses to spend her time with. And we are the largest provider of services for people seeking asylum and refugees in the UK. So last year we saw about 40,000 people. My colleagues tell me that increasingly our work is at the sharp end of destitution. So we're not looking at move-on or employment prospects or resettlement. We're looking at destitution, just as Alvina talked about, food poverty. I've sat in meetings with people in our services where we've discussed how to get to the food bank before it shuts at 1 o'clock. The fact that hotel accommodation, just like you say, sounds fancy, it's not. No catering facilities. If you're there with children, you're stuck. You've got enough money for the bus fare to the centre, but how to get home and then how to navigate your food. So it's not just the numbers. At the end of last year, the backlog was 129,000 people. It's the fact that we lose people in those numbers that I think. So we know that the backlog is in part caused by, you know, in pragmatic terms, is caused by caseworker productivity. So decisions are being made less efficiently. It looks like overall there's been a reduction in the backlog, but we also know that 25,000 people last year withdrew from the system. Some of them maybe not willingly. We need to understand much more about what's actually happening there. And we know that we get people stuck now, thanks to the Illegal Migration Act, just stuck indefinitely, not able to make a claim. It is no way to treat fellow human beings. And it is not going to get better unless we do some fundamental things. One is introducing a whole system approach. So to be making sure that different parts of the system are speaking with each other. We could talk about the disconnect between national and local government and the problems that creates, for example, in the housing area of things. We could talk about the fact that we've now had multiple legislative changes in recent years that create different cohorts of people who become numbers on a spreadsheet, all having horrific experiences, but which are dealt with by numbers and percentages and productivity. No surprise, I feel incredibly strongly that what also would change it is listening to the experts, the people who've been through the system, the people who have that understanding of this is where the problems are and this is what we need to do. Fundamentally, the challenge I would put to all political parties is that by not having a response that at its heart has a heart and compassion, believing that by being unkind we are saving money, is fundamentally what needs to change. We need to understand that actually having that compassion, whatever route somebody gets here by, because let's be real about this, nobody gets permission to flee persecution. You don't get a certificate to grant you rights. You know, we have to have safe routes that people can use, and then we have to treat people fairly, compassionately and speedily in the way that we know we can do to really make a dress to this system.
Thank you, Sal. You mentioned the politics, and I wanted to come to you, Lizzie, on that. Asylum is clearly subject to a huge amount of political focus ahead of the election, but I was interested in your thoughts on how the political spotlight affects the way that policy and operations are run in the asylum system, and actually the reverse. So how much do the sort of policy and operational challenges that we've experienced intensify the political spotlight?
So hi, everyone. Thanks for having me. I mean, Philip may be able to do a comparison, but in my experience covering Home Affairs for the past 7 or so years, we're definitely seeing the kind of fastest and most volatile kind of political interference in the operation of the asylum system. And obviously the government sets policy, the government creates legislation, you know, that's how things work. But what we've seen in recent years is a very, very rapid and sometimes contradictory wave of completely disjointed policy making that's extremely reactive. So in other areas of policy, the government will come out with a 1 year, 3 year, 5 year plan that kind of looks at an issue cohesively and tries to deal with it in a way that makes sense. That isn't happening with asylum, and it hasn't been happening for some time. So because of how different Conservative leaders and different Conservative governments have perceived different public concerns to be important, and also because of how they've perceived pressure from within their own parties, within all the kind of coups and things that we've had, they've started making policy very quickly with little or no evidence, kind of because they just want to be seen to be doing something. And that's always an arbiter of really bad policy, and it can be seen here in so many different ways. Like the previous speakers have said, we've had different laws coming on one on top of each other. We've had the Rwanda scheme, which has taken a completely different complexion today. We've had hotels being used and then trying to stop using them, and then trying to use military barracks, and then trying to use barges. And we can just see this pattern again and again and again of the government trying to project an image of control, but doing things which either don't work, have unintended side effects, or have completely unforeseen consequences when they start clashing with other things that the government or the previous government has done. And the kind of the picture of short-term political gain for kind of long-term practical pain, I think, is being seen really clearly now. With the backlog, for example, when Rishi Sunak made the pledge to clear what he called the legacy backlog, which at that time was about 90,000 asylum claims within a year, the internal advice instantly was that it couldn't be done. Of course it couldn't be done. And so what happened was a whole wealth of policy and procedure was just ripped up to achieve that aim. And the consequences of that are only starting to be seen now. We had asylum interviews cut to 2 hours, questionnaires sent out to some high grant nationalities, but only in English. Withdrawals, I think, quadrupled, and most of them aren't consensual. Most of the withdrawals Home Office stats showed are basically the Home Office just removing claims from the system without necessarily being even in contact with the person involved. And so now, of course, appeals are rocketing. And the National Audit Office in June said that already by July 2022, the Home Office forecast that there would be 75,000 undecided asylum appeals by March 2025. But that estimate was actually done 6 months before Rishi Sunak made the backlog pledge. And so that 75,000, it is going to be much, much higher now. And a cynic would say the government knows that this will be the next government's problem. You know, whatever they say publicly, the Conservatives are sure they will lose. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how much of this kind of bad policy, kind of politically driven, evidence-free policy, how soon the consequences of that will become apparent.
Thank you. And you've sort of made very clear how stark some of the problems are at the moment in the asylum system. But, Philip, I wanted to come to you on just how far back the roots of those problems go and why asylum has been such a difficult challenge for successive governments, and how you think the Home Office can try and break out of the kind of crisis response mode that Lizzie described so well and kind of improve the system and have it more stable and working into the future.
So I think the fundamental reason why it's such a difficult area is because there's a lack of consensus around it. There are immensely strong feelings on all sides of the debate, and there is also some evidence on all sides of the debate. The evidence may not be of equal value and equal weight, but nonetheless, there are powerful points made, I would say, across the political divide on this. On the one hand, Albina's spoken very powerfully about the real trauma suffered by people coming here to claim asylum. And you only need to look at the grant rates for asylum in not just the UK, but other industrial countries to see, of course, there's a fundamental issue here, fundamental problem around persecution, fear, suffering, very, very real phenomena, which we have to recognise. And on the other hand, you have the fact that I would say for any government of any likely political complexion, control of the border, the sense that that government has a control of who comes into the country and the circumstances under which they come in, that is a fundamental expectation that I think any likely Home Secretary is going to need to meet. You also have the fact that the Home Office, I've long since left it, but I'm sure they are dealing today with real issues around criminality in terms of the flows of people into the UK in order to claim asylum. They may be exaggerated. Sal may want to say something about that, but that there are real issues about criminality and the real issues around patterns of incentives, I think, are also valid points. So this is an immensely charged issue. And of course, like many immensely charged issues in political life, it then gets used in different ways in order to serve political agendas. All of that means that fundamentally the ratio between heat and light, if you like, in this area of political debate, of policy debate, is not what you would like. There's a lot of strong feelings, rather less, I would say, by way of standing back, thinking about fundamental objectives, thinking about trade-offs, thinking about intrinsic difficulties, practical difficulties, all sorts of, as well as recognising that we're dealing with human beings here, and the stakes are very high. The stakes for the individual's life, the individual's welfare, could hardly be higher. I used to think that about the task faced by the asylum decision makers, relatively junior staff who had this incredibly weighty decision that they were responsible for. How to break out of the crisis mindset? Yes, well, I spent quite a lot of time thinking about that when I was in the Home Office. So the Home Office is very accustomed to dealing with crises. The crisis muscle, if you like, crisis response muscle, is very well developed. But as in any difficult, complex area of policy, or more widely, to break out of crisis, break out of recurrent crisis, what you have to do is to take a systemic viewpoint, stand back from the crisis, retain critically enough bandwidth, enough energy, both political and official, to think and develop and then implement more fundamental solutions to reduce the probability of crises in the future and get better at dealing with them. And what does that mean in practice? It means building organisational capacity, capacity to anticipate crises, but also capacity to respond to them, preferably to avoid them. It means, to my mind, really building a better evidence base. That goes to the point about consensus. I'm not naive about how quickly we're going to achieve anything more like consensus in this area of policy in the UK, but I think we should aim at it. So how might we get there? Having a better, shared, recognised evidence base would be, I think, really would be part of it. And then thirdly, it comes to the point about choosing your objectives. And the objectives really have to be chosen by politicians. That's their job, after all. But setting objectives that are more rather than less realistic, I would encourage that. Recognise, we tend overwhelmingly to talk about this as a domestic issue, but recognise actually it's fundamentally an international issue, it's a global issue at so many different levels. So setting objectives that recognise that and also take account of the UK's wider international objectives. After all, we're a permanent member of the Security Council. We have all sorts of international goals which are relevant to this.
Great, thank you so much. Arvina, I was going to come back to you and just touch on one of the things that came up in the Wendy Williams review into the Windrush scandal in the Home Office, and she raised the issue that the Home Office often struggles to see the face behind the case. And I was interested in whether that rang true in reflections from your time through the process and also the wider Voices Network. Is that a shared view?
Absolutely. I was going to say as well that it's become so clear from all the speakers that, the policies and the system more broadly is not set up to recognise the person, mm-hmm. behind the claim for asylum. So I want to give an example. When I first claimed asylum, I was in Scotland, and I was told that I had to go to Croydon for it, and there was no provision for transport. And we all know how exorbitant the fares from Scotland to London are, so I resorted to the overnight bus. Bear in mind, at the time, I was 6 months pregnant, so I had to sit through the overnight. I think it's about 10, 11 hours, and I made it first thing. My appointment in Croydon was for 9 o'clock. I got there right on time, and there was no consideration. I just wasn't asked any questions, whether I had any needs or anything. So like everybody else, I was sat all day on the very hard seats in the room. There was no water, no food, no nothing. And I had no expectation of this at all. And being homeless and an asylum seeker, I just had no money at all. So I literally just went through the whole day with no food and nothing. So even in that way, like, as we progress through the day, you obviously get anticipatory anxiety. When a door opens, you look up, you think, oh, is it me, is it my turn? And it really wasn't. So I was there 9 o'clock in the morning, and the place is supposed to close at 5:30. I wasn't called into my interview until 4:45. So this is me thinking, oh. So even when my name came up, I just burst out into tears. And as soon as I walked in the room, thankfully it was a woman that was interviewing me. And it was just then that she said, oh, I didn't realize you're pregnant. So even at that, you know, it was just a case of, I think that's where even some people would go wrong in their interviews, because you're already nervous. You know, you're already in a state, so even for you to get your story right or your facts right, I was worried about the time. I was worried about getting back to Victoria to catch my coach back. So, and then thankfully she was okay, and then she said, oh, well, we'll have to rush through your interview. And that also was supposed to make me feel better, but it actually made me feel worse that, you know, I was literally here all day and I wouldn't have time to, you know, say or put my points across. So also just getting back to Glasgow, when I did go back and I was in the process of being accommodated, like they were looking for housing for me, I was first in contact with a social worker that said to me, well, suddenly you're pregnant, because initially they were like, we cannot help you. And I'm thinking, okay. I did tell the other lady that I was pregnant. Then it was like, oh, suddenly, so you're pregnant. Then he asked me to prove that I was pregnant. So besides maybe, I don't know, not looking pregnant, I don't know what other evidence I was supposed to give. Am I supposed to walk around with my papers or pictures of my belly, or I had to strip down to show him that I was pregnant? So I think some of these things, they're really, really despicable. Mm. And these are things that are happening on the daily. I mentioned earlier also that when I was eventually accommodated, I was in and out of hotel accommodation for 5 weeks. And I have described earlier how the accommodation was, and it was pretty much consistent throughout all the hotels that I lived. But I never was in one place for 3 days at a stretch. So I'd be in this place for 1 day, I'll be in this place for 3 days, and back in the other place for 2 days. So it's all that shuffling, all that moving about. And you know what the worst thing is? You have no money, you have £30 to live on, and you're being shuffled with taxis. You have a taxi that's picking you up from this hotel and that hotel, and you're literally paying £27 here, £30 there, £17 there. And in my head, I'm doing all these calculations of, do you know what I can do with that money? Mm. Yeah. So even at that, being 6 months pregnant and having all of these issues going on, I'm historically hypertensive, and I had gestational diabetes, and I was asked by the hospital to come in every single day to have daily checks. They needed to check my baby because most times I would not be able to feel the baby moving. So that also left me in a pickle because I had to choose between going to the hospital, that's again £5. I think back then it was £5 a day for the bus, or £4.80, I can't remember. But seeing as I only had £30, and then I had to spend £35. So in the end, you know, you're forced to make these difficult choices of, do I go to hospital, or do I get food, or do I get whatever? So this is like a classic case of there was no assessment done to, you know, assess my needs. And there was absolutely no information about, you know, if I went to hospital, if I had a hospital letter, I could get my travel expenses reimbursed. That would have, like, you know, decreased some of my worries, because at least if I have some money reimbursed, then I can have free up some money for some food. So that's literally the case that's happening all the time. So I think, again, what would help is to have a system that is trauma-informed. All of these assessments should have been done, should have been picked up from the get, that, you know, somebody's got extra needs. Myself, I was pregnant, I was diabetic, and I was hypertensive. Things like that should be taken into account. And also that staff should also be trained on trauma. You know, that's very, very important. You know, when they're dealing with people that are coming from traumatic backgrounds, that needs to be the soul of, you know, like the first point of contact. You are met with somebody that understands, or that at least has training on what you're going through. So basically, I think that's what I wanted to cover on that case. Yeah.
Thank you.
I
was going to come to you next, Sal, and just the Homes for Ukraine scheme showed that actually the UK does have the capacity to welcome a large number of people seeking sanctuary at pace. What are the lessons from that scheme for the wider asylum policy and operations? And what are the lessons about the politics too?
I think the really fascinating thing is putting that in the same context. So over 200,000 people have successfully applied through that scheme. And putting that in the context of, Philip, what you were saying about a fundamental objective for any Home Secretary to be to control our borders. And it's remarkable what we can achieve when we decide to have compassion and actually create safe routes to support people to flee their homes, schools, places of work being destroyed. It's amazing what we can do. I'm really interested in this question around how we are more rather than less realistic about what's possible. I think what Alvina describes really clearly is just how expensive it is. I'm trying not to say be mean, but it's really expensive to be mean, and we need to stop doing that. I think there's something, I think the scheme from Ukraine just shows that it's entirely possible to do that. Now, I think there's something else that we haven't touched on so far, is actually while people are in limbo, and I'm just going to read out this figure because I've just mentioned 200,000 people coming through, but at the end of December, there were over 125,000 people waiting for that initial decision on their asylum claim. Two-thirds of those had been waiting for longer than 6 months, whereas the Ukraine visa schemes, typically people wait less than 3 weeks for that application to be processed. Mm-hmm. So think about all of those individuals, hundreds, thousands, 125,000 people whose lives are in limbo, who are not able to work, who are not able to contribute. These are incredibly talented people who just happen to be born in a place that is experiencing war. That's the difference. And so I think for me, the real nub of it has to be how taking that lesson, because I think it's a really interesting point about that expectation about controlling our borders and in association with criminality. I would say that the more we introduce safe routes, the more we'll tackle criminality, frankly, because we will be supporting people once they arrive as well to resettle. So I think that, you know, there's a whole complicated picture there around the fact that we thoroughly endorse criminality by not having safe routes. So there's something for me about how do we make it the greater objective to show compassion? And that's before we've even got onto the economy and benefits to the economy, which would be another evening.
Yeah. And I'm conscious we want to get to questions from the floor, but I will ask a couple more questions up on the panel, if that's okay with you all. I was going to come to you, Philip, on the question around capability and capacity in the Home Office, and particularly around decision-making and the decision-makers in the workforce who are responsible for making decisions. What do you think needs to be done inside the department to improve both the quality of the decisions that are being made, but also the pace?
So I'll answer that, but can I say something else first of all, which is, so it's very interesting in this discussion, so much focus on the backlog.
Yeah.
I predict the backlog will get dealt with. It's a crisis. The Home Office will deal with the crisis. The backlog will come down. Probably most of the benefit will be seen after the election. That crisis will be ticked off the list. The real issue that I think should be focused on is what is the right model after the backlog is dealt with?
Yeah.
What does good look like for a sustainable system? Let's suppose that, at least for a period, let's suppose that the Home Secretary, whoever it is after the election, gets at least a year without another crisis. That's rather an ambitious length of time, by the way, maybe less than a year. But let's suppose, what would good look like in an equilibrium situation without the crisis? And in terms of capacity and capability, I think that's about designing what would a good model look like. There are lots of elements already in, I mean, I left 4 years ago, but lots of elements already in the Home Office which would meet the definition of good. Surprising, you actually have a committed workforce. You have lots and lots of talented people, people who work incredibly hard, go the extra mile to try to make the system work, often against the odds. But how can we make sure that we have, in the round, enough of them? When I was in the Home Office, we faced an issue around a rising asylum backlog. We thought the right answer was to introduce a productivity initiative. Actually, I inherited one productivity initiative, which wasn't working, so we introduced another productivity initiative. With hindsight, I'm not sure that was quite the right way to go, because that's telling people you just have to, if not work harder, work more effectively, which can sound like working harder. I think, again, with hindsight, maybe we should have focused more on building a culture of high morale, high motivation, and the productivity would have flowed out of that. I'm sort of speculating a bit here. So my basic point is, let's think beyond the immediate crisis as to what good would look like and how, from an administrative point of view, which is obviously kind of my background, what really would look like there in terms of numbers of people, skill levels, the data that they should have availability to, quality of data, that's a key issue, systems, the culture, and how you retain, in what is inevitably a high throughput business, you retain the human dimension, which is, for all the reasons we've heard, absolutely critical to the person on the other end of what can seem like very sort of, in itself, risks being a traumatizing process. It's certainly a high-stress process. But it's fundamental to the overall integrity of the system and the motivation and morale of the people you need to run it.
Thank you, Philip. Last question before we come to the floor, so get them all ready, is to Lizzie. I'm hoping you can give us a note of optimism to end on. The sort of political focus in this area has driven churn in policies, churn in ministers. So you were talking about earlier almost annual announcements of major pieces of legislation. How can the winner of the next election, whoever it is, try and break that political cycle?
I think it will, I guess it will be easier in a way because they won't have an election looming in the way that the current government has. You know, we're seeing the kind of desperation play out at the moment, for example, with getting any flight off to Rwanda. But on the other hand, it probably won't be that much easier for them because they will be left with all of this legislation and they will be left with all of this policy and process. And it's going to be really difficult to actually unscramble the eggs. A lot of the legislation hasn't been brought into force yet, even parts of the Nationality and Borders Act, which was passed almost 2 years ago now. But the stuff that has really radically changed the process by which asylum claims are considered. And so the next government will either have to do something really radical in terms of repealing laws, or it will have to kind of tinker around the edges and trying to beat what we've got in, into a shape that vaguely works, because there isn't as much room for manoeuvre as people think, well, as a lot of the public, I imagine, think there is, because basically our whole asylum system was originally built to give effect to the Refugee Convention, which we're still a signatory of, and that basically defines what a refugee is, and it kind of has set a series of criteria that the government does its best to assess, and that will be something that the government, you know, will always have to do, and how they do that kind of remains to be seen.
Thank you. So, questions from the floor. I will try and alternate between those in the room and those who have submitted questions online. So if you are online and want to submit a question, it's not too late. There's going to be a roving mic. I'm going to try and take questions in tranches. But if you could put your hand up now and then wait for the microphone to come to you and say your name and organisation very quickly. If you're in next door and would like to ask a question, just wing your head round the door. Great. The lady here first.
Juliet from the Home Office. I'm really interested to know, are there examples of countries overseas that are doing asylum policy making particularly well? And if so, why? And what can we copy from them?
Brilliant. Thank you. And then the lady two seats behind.
I'm Ramel. I'm one of the British Red Cross volunteers from the advocacy team. I'm really concerned about the Rwanda bill trying to pass. I want to know if the Home Office considered the fact that Rwanda has been killing Congolese. So basically, Rwanda's still in war. And actually, the Congolese president, not long ago, did say that if Rwanda continue to do what they're doing in Congo, Congo going to counter-attack. So I want to know, why is the Home Office basically siding with Rwanda? Are they considering the 6 million of people who die since 1996? And also I want to know, since you want to send refugee back there, what happened then if the Congo then go and then start also basically retaliating to Rwanda?
Great, thank you very much. And then I think there was just a gentleman just there. We'll come to others.
Hello, Roger Goff, leader of Kent County Council. A question about, which was touched on, which is the central local relationship and housing. How is that best addressed? Because that is at the sort of end of the line of this process and ultimately a hugely sensitive matter. So what you've seen most recently is that the government has talked about going to local authorities to ask their what they would be willing to take in terms of people as part of safe and legal routes. And of course, in the current situation, local authorities have a pretty powerful pressure on them to say, actually, we're going to lowball that or put in a zero return because of the degree of pressure that there is on housing overall. But that clearly has to be addressed. And at the moment, we're seeing, as the degree of decisions on asylum does increase, that feeds straight through again into those housing and homelessness pressures. So how do we actually get it that this can be dealt with in a way that doesn't become hugely sensitive and difficult, because there are so many pressures domestically on homelessness that seem to respond to that could well be itself politically and socially quite challenging.
Great, thank you very much. I will offer each of the panel an opportunity to come back on the questions that they feel are relevant to them. I don't know, Alvina, if you want to come in on any of those questions.
I wanted to address, I'm sorry I forgot your name, the lady that asked the question first.
About international comparatives?
Yes.
Yes.
I don't know any international comparatives, but I was going to talk about, you know, the value of the Home Office using people with lived experience. So I know this model is tried and tested. We do it everywhere, you know, where you have peer-to-peer support. People feel less threatened, people are comfortable to contribute. So I know these terms are being thrown about a lot, like lived experience, and some people don't like them, and experts by experience, but like it or not, that's what it is, that's what we are. We live it, we know it, we've been through the system, and we can inform from that perspective because that's our daily lives, and before things change, I think there's real value in consulting people that are going through the asylum system. I know that there is an advisory board that the Home Office has, a lived experience advisory board, but at the same time, I'm told that it's limited to the people who've got refugee status already. But this is really sad because people with refugee status, they have got other things to concentrate on. Their moving on journey is quite complex and it's quite difficult as well. So they don't know, or they lose out, they lose touch with what's happening on the ground. So I feel like the government should foster that, you know, environment where people feel safe to contribute and people feel safe, you know, that if and when they inform on the government policies or the asylum policy, it will not be detrimental to their case. It will not by any means, you know, work against them. It's not detrimental to the asylum case. That's my contribution. Thank you.
Thanks, Alvina. Sal, anything on international comparators? Is there anywhere that the British Red Cross thinks does this particularly well, or do you have any reflections on the sort of central local relationship you touched on earlier when in one of the remarks?
And it was me who raised that. I think it doesn't, to be honest, it doesn't matter which sector you work in, whether it's housing or youth offending, or the fact of it is that there's always seems to be a disconnect between local and national government, and I think fundamentally it's to do with who's paying for what and who foots the bill at what stage, and then what people are prepared to pay for, because what might be the greater cost isn't their budget, or what might be the sooner cost, the more immediate cost, is their budget. And I think it's about aligning that. So what we've seen, so I mentioned that we're the largest provider of services for refugees and people seeking asylum. We see this all the time, that people are really struggling with move on. So there's a fundamental disconnect where the government has changed the way it views the move on period. So some people we've worked with have had as little as 7 days notice. So great, you've got your status, 7 days notice. It's just not workable. That has to change to be 56 days. But just to give you some examples of what this has meant, in Leicester, we've been handing out sleeping bags to people. I mean, you know, we are a humanitarian agency. Our strapline is we are there for people in times of crisis together across the world. We shouldn't be handing out sleeping bags in Leicester. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be working with somebody in Essex who, having been given a sleeping bag by us, then had all their stuff stolen, or people with HIV who are sleeping rough. This isn't what we should be doing. So we have to find a way to fix that disconnect. So I think the increasing that time in line with the Homelessness Reduction Act to be 56 days is a key step to it. But we also would like to see greater coordination between strategic migration partnerships and that data sharing. I think that the fundamental point has to come to understanding that actually central and local government should actually share an objective, not to be too simplistic about it, but we need to have shared objectives about actually what we're doing to show compassion and resettle people. I mean, in terms of international comparisons, I would say that the three things that we look for are a safe route, accepting that that this will be the best way, the most effective way. We're part of a world, you know, we are an island, but we're part of a globe where there are more displaced people than ever before, so we have to create safe routes. We have to then review, assess, deal with people's cases as quickly and compassionately, recognising the trauma that, Alvina, you've spoken so well about, that people are facing already, and not making that worse. We've got to do that really quickly. And then we've got to support people to integrate and to rebuild their lives. I just imagine that if you're fleeing, that everything you own is everything that you can carry, and that's all that you have. So we have to do that really compassionately and then link those objectives up across national and local government.
Great, thank you. And Lizzie, you wanted to come in on the Rwanda and Congo question.
Yeah, just because I covered the legal battle all the way through the courts, and there was evidence on what the British government knew and what it took into consideration regarding Rwanda's various human rights abuses. And it wasn't actually contested that Rwanda's a one-party autocratic state where political dissidents are tortured, killed, assassinated at home and abroad. It also wasn't contested by the government that the Rwandan regime has been funding parties to the war in Congo. And actually, it was the reason that about 10 years ago, the UK government actually paused development funding to Rwanda for the same reason. So it's something that's known and accepted in the government more widely. And it's also one of the reasons that when, at the dawn of this policy in late 2021, when the Home Office asked the Foreign Office to draw up a list of countries which would be suitable for a migration partnership of the type that the Rwanda scheme became, Rwanda was ruled out almost instantly by the Foreign Office and by the British High Commission in Rwanda, and advice went to Number 10 and to the Home Office, saying everything that was happening in Congo, the shooting of refugees in the Kasiba refugee camp, the awful deal with Israel, like the Home Office was aware of all of it. And basically, they made a deliberate decision to not consider it because their position, which ultimately lost at the Supreme Court, was that the past didn't matter because Rwanda had made new promises to the government, and they basically tried to kind of cordon off the deal that they'd done with Rwanda, and say all that matters is what they've promised us, and we've given them a load of money, so we don't think that any of that stuff matters.
Thank you, Lizzie. Philip, are any of those questions you want to come back in on?
Just briefly, so on international comparisons, I don't know, is the honest answer, whether there are other countries which do policy much better than us. I think it would be worth, however, doing some sort of benchmarking exercise, reasonably serious comparative exercise, looking at how other countries deal with this issue administratively, if you like. How do they, in particular, lots of European countries face this issue of volatile demand. Demand goes up, you have a workforce which is of a fixed size, you immediately get a backlog, you're immediately, you know, pedaling twice as hard just to try to stay still. It's not a very great place to be. Are there lessons that we could learn, go back to my point about what's the model like after the backlog has basically gone? Are there lessons we could learn from looking at, say, half a dozen or eight comparative countries in Europe and beyond? On the local government, central government point, I completely agree. Obviously, money is always going to be a point of tension. It is in this area, it is in other areas as well. But I come back to my, and housing, anything that involves housing is also going to be a further point of tension given the housing, wider housing constraints that we face at the moment. I come back to my point though, if it were possible to build a greater sense of consensus, Sal's point about shared objectives, all sorts of other things become possible. In the absence of a consensus, all sorts of things become difficult because they start to be used as vehicles for playing out, if you like, that divergence of views. I don't want to be over-optimistic, but I would strongly encourage politicians who are in charge of this area to think about how, over time, more by way of a consensus sense of shared objectives can be built, because I think that will pay all sorts of dividends. I mean, look at what happened on the Ukrainian refugee. There was a national consensus about it. All sorts of things became possible, including cooperation between national and local government. The vulnerable persons resettlement scheme that relocated about 20,000 particularly vulnerable people from the refugee camps around Syria. Again, excellent cooperation on the whole between local and national government.
Great, thank you. We'll do one more round of questions in the room, and then I'll do a few from here before I let you get the drinks. But we've got one question here. This one here, yeah.
Hello, Jake from the Cabinet Office. We saw last night in the Times the fact that they were considering proposing a payment for potential asylum seekers to go willingly to Rwanda. And I was wondering just what the panel thought generally on the concept of putting money forward there to try and, you know, not necessarily influence, but allow people to make the decision to go to different countries for asylum.
Great, thank you. Question here at the end.
Hi, Rasika from DLAC. I was generally interested on the idea of exploring what is good. The comment about the Homes for Ukraine scheme and how that could be a model. But considering every conflict and every cohort comes with its own challenges and bespoke needs, do you think we could actually rip off any of the existing schemes and do a generic framework that, you know, one-size-fits-all approach? Is that possible at all? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Then there was one in this corner here, and then we'll do four.
Hi, thanks. I'm Sheila. I'm Freedom from Torture. Thanks to the panel. That was really interesting. It's been a great discussion so far. I've got a quick question. I just wanted to first sort of, congratulate or I'm happy for the optimism that Sir Philip has expressed around clearance of the backlog. I really hope that the public and political will around that doesn't time out before the Home Office manages to do that. I also just wanted to recognise that backlog, I mean, while being a crisis is not a new one, it's been a problem for a very long time, the issue of delays in asylum decision making, certainly for our clients who often and for a very long time have been waiting years for decisions on their asylum claims. And, you know, some of us have in the room have lived through a number of Home Office exercises to clear backlogs, the Older Life Cases Unit, various legacy clearance exercises. And, you know, we always see a new backlog growing over time because ultimately the problems, the systemic problems, are not addressed. And, you know, I think the things you've suggested around structural reform within the Home Office are really important, and, you know, investing in staff in systems, you know, the really basic sort of not exciting reforms that need to happen, but that could really transform the way they make decisions, are so important to do. But my worry is that, you know, what will characterize the backlog going forward will be actually the extent to which it's made up of people who have no access to the system, so the inadmissible cases. And while we all want a well-functioning, effective, fast and efficient asylum decision-making process, who will it be for? Which cases will it be considering? And what does a government do about a backlog that is made up of such a considerable number of cases that are not going to be admitted to the system and that cannot be removed, cannot be sent anywhere in the absence of returns or relocation or admission agreements? And I think that is the real challenge that faces, you know, a government of any nature that is you know, taking over the running of the Home Office towards the end of this year.
Great, thank you very much. And then there was someone at the back of the room, a lady at the back in the corner.
Hi, Preet from the City of London Corporation. My question is about immigration in general, whether it's economic migrants or whether we're talking about asylum seekers. Currently, UK and the rest of the Europe is facing an aging population. And in the UK itself, we have 21% of working age population, which is currently unemployed. But at the same time, last year, according to the Office of National Statistics, we had about 1.18 million immigrants, which was at a record high. So how would governments, whether it's this or the, you know, next government, can strike a balance and ensure, and how to solve this paradox of, you know, filling in the labour gaps that are needed, and henceforth whether that's getting more people into workforce or whether that's, you know, getting more migrants, but at the same time also, you know, ensuring that they don't put a pressure on, you know, housing, you know, NHS, etc. Thank you.
Great, thank you so much. So we have got reflections on the announcement around Rwanda and the payments, whether or not there's a one-size-fits-all approach that we could learn from some of the models that currently exist to apply into the asylum system. What do we do about inadmissible, and how does the next government manage that challenge? And then reflections on the sort of the labour market implications. I might start with you, Philip, and go down this way this time, if that's okay.
So I'll just pick up a couple of those. I only know about the latest thing vis-a-vis Rwanda, what I saw in the same newspaper as you. It's not unprecedented. In fact, there are a number of precedents for paying people, not huge sums, but paying people to return I'm afraid I don't know what the wider policy is, but there certainly have been policies in the past where people have been paid of the order of £1,500 in order to voluntarily return to a country. So in a sense, what is new about this, I think, apart from the fact that it's joined with that word Rwanda, which obviously attracts an enormous amount of attention, what is new about this is that the individuals would be going to a third country, not be being paid to go back to their own country. I will wait to see if the policy, what effect the policy has. I think the inadmissible cases point is a very good one, and I would put that in the sort of basket of things that a new that Lizzie referred to that a new government might face. Difficult questions, and you can just see how, for a new arriving Home Secretary, a pile of difficult questions will be waiting for them, and that will be one of them, because, you know, if you decide to admit the inadmissible cases and start considering them, you might have to change the law, no doubt, to do that, but that will create a great deal of political controversy. What I would hope, inevitably, ministers at any time are going to be focused on the issues of the day. And after the election, I'm sure whoever is in power again will be in the Home Office, as in other departments, even more in the Home Office than other departments, will be focused on the issues of the day. What I would hope is that they devote enough bandwidth and attention to thinking beyond the immediate issues about what might good look like and how do we get there. The systemic issues, whether administrative or international legal framework or whatever they are, because otherwise we will keep on finding ourselves. We will be here in 24 years' time. It'll be a different set of crises, but we have to think about what is our collective room for manoeuvre as a country to get out of being so reactive on a really hard, really important set of issues.
Great, thank you. I'll come to you, Lizzie, next, and if we can try and keep remarks brief, because then we can get to another set of very brief questions from online.
So just on the inadmissibility point, a lot of the case, basically what the government did was start considering all small boat asylum claims as inadmissible, meaning that they wouldn't even look at the merits of the asylum claim. And that was also the basis of the first Rwanda deal. But what they started doing is just timing them out after 6 months. So very quietly, without any kind of formal admission that that's the case, thousands and thousands of people who were considered for inadmissibility have now been decided anyway. And a lot of those decisions happened in the backlog. So we do have some cohorts that are completely stuck because of weird interactions between different parts of different laws. But they have already been very quietly climbing down on inadmissibility. And if that continued and the attempts to make people inadmissible stopped as a policy decision, they could just race through that without actually changing the law, if they wanted to. And on the new voluntary scheme, if anyone wants to read about this, just going to plug my article that went live at 6 o'clock in the eye with all the details, more details than the Times had. So this policy was actually brought in secret 2 days ago and enacted without being announced. There was an undisclosed deal with Rwanda that they still haven't published. They won't say what it says. They won't say how much it cost. You know, it's all getting very familiar now. And what it is, as Philip alluded to, is an extension on existing voluntary return schemes that were designed for people returning to their country of origin. The internal guidance on the 11th of March changed to say you can choose to return to your home country if your asylum claim has been decided against, not declared inadmissible, not selected for Rwanda, but actually if there has been a decision and the decision is that you don't get asylum, you can now not only choose to go to your country of origin, but you can choose to go to Rwanda. And the £3,000 described is actually the financial support that was offered under the pre-existing scheme. But what they're trying to kind of tempt people with is Rwanda is they're saying that if you go voluntarily, you will get the 5-year support in housing, financial support, integration, language, training, etc., as people would when they get forcibly deported there. So I think it's a tacit admission, if it wasn't obvious already, that a plane was never going to take off under the original scheme. And in what actually might work, they're now trying to bypass the Supreme Court ruling and absolutely everything around it by saying, well, we don't need to worry about that if we can convince people to choose to go voluntarily.
Thank you very much.
Any remarks on those questions?
Yeah, just I'll keep it brief.
Please do, please do.
I can see you're looking at questions. Outsourcing asylum obligations to another country just has no place in our system. The more I hear about it, it's just absurd that this is where we are. The money would be much better spent actually dealing with the backlog, resourcing the system effectively, getting those connections that we've talked about. And I think, Raz, just thinking about your question, and this just speaks to the international comparisons, it's that template, isn't it? It's basically look at what we can do when we decide we want to. So by actually creating safe routes, by dealing with processing applications quickly, humanely, and then supporting people to resettle, we can get apparently 200,000 people here in 2 years, part of the communities. I think it's absurd what's happening with the Rwanda policy on every different stage of it. There are so many different elements of legislation now that we know we'd have to have more legislation to unpick what's gone on as well. I think fundamentally, so this is the ambition, we just need a whole new approach, just a small thing is what we're looking for.
Anything you wanted to come in with?
I'll just add very quickly on the Rwanda scheme that, you know, that scheme in itself is cruel. It's been rejected by the ECHR. It's been rejected by the House of Commons and the larger asylum and refugee community. So even for that to go ahead is just a breach of human rights. And I don't know why the UK is... that lady spoke about, you know, there is fights going on between the neighboring countries as well. Rwanda has one of the most, one of the worst human rights records in the world. There is no rule of law in the country. There's extrajudicial killings. I think, don't quote me on this, but a few years ago, I think 2018, they gunned down few people that were in detention. They complained about not having enough food, rationing food or something, and they were gunned down. And these were people already in detention. So if they can do that to people that are already there, what's to say of the people that will be coming from here? And from all the time that we were campaigning against the Rwanda scheme, there is the money that's being offered or whatever you get to get to Rwanda is a fraction of what actually is costing to be able to send somebody out. You know, there's just so many costs involved that are not being, they're not being transparent about.
Great, thank you. Yeah. So two very last, very quick questions from me from those online. According to NISA, allowing people seeking asylum the right to work would increase tax revenue by 1.3 billion, reduce government expenditure by 6.7 billion, and increase GDP by 1.6 billion. What do people think about lifting the ban? So, brief answer on that. And then, how can we avoid polarizing rhetoric that we see from both left and right in order to establish more humane approaches to irregular migration in the UK? So, two brief questions, brief answers. I might start with you, Alvina. Lifting the ban on working?
Well, I've been campaigning on lifting the ban for years. And I think just going back to what I've said before about allowing asylum seekers to work, people want to work, they want to contribute to the economy, they want to pay their own national insurance and tax. So being able to do that, it takes the pressure off the government looking after people or saying that they are looking after them. People can do and fare so much better if they are allowed to work and look after their own welfare than being subjected to poverty in the sense that, you know, they are literally waiting for stipends from the government that is not working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So?
Absolutely, lift the ban. I think it's staggering how much being mean costs money, which I know I'm a stuck record. This point about rhetoric and this absence of compassion, it comes back down to, I think, and this is something that matters to the British Red Cross a lot because we are fiercely independent, impartial and neutral. It's telling the stories. It's allowing people to say what their experiences have been and listening. So I think it's really moving away from that. That takes time. We have a culture, a society where we don't like to admit that we're wrong. refer to the Rwanda policy. Politicians don't like to admit that they've changed their minds or that they didn't know, but we have to actually have just fact-based evidence. There is no evidence for so much that's happening now, and actually we need to be listening and just remembering people at the very heart.
Great, thank you very much. Lizzie, and then Philip, if there's anything you want to add.
Yeah, I think the work ban is a real, really interesting illustration of how political priorities change over time. It was introduced, I think, actually by the Labour government because at the time the concern of the day was about asylum seekers taking our jobs. And then however many years later, the concern has flipped to asylum seekers being work shy and taking our public money. So I don't think this government would ever lift it, and I don't think a Labour government would either, at least not totally. And part of the reason is this government has become very wedded to the idea of deterrence. Until the whole voluntary thing happened today, all of its policies for the last 5 years have claimed that they will deter small boat arrivals. And they haven't, and it hasn't worked, and there was never any evidence. But the government considers the right to work a pull factor, and for that reason they won't budge.
So I'm going to link my answer to, I think I've got a common theme in response to both those questions, which is that the key to better policy making is better evidence. That's one thing we could actually do as a country. The politics will still be there, of course, and people will take different views of the evidence, but we could actually aim to have, over time, a better evidence-based, objective, respected, accepted widely across different areas of the political system, as public policy evidence is in many other areas. We could aim to have that in this area too. So on lifting the ban, I mean, the argument typically made against lifting the ban is that there's an incentive issue. But I honestly don't know. I hear the numbers from NISA, but what does the evidence actually say about whether it would incentivise or not more or fewer people to come to the UK through these routes? To have a ban on employment or not to have the ban? And equally, I've look at the evidence that's available, go to the point about polarising rhetoric. It seems that we have very little that really tells us what happens to people who are arrive in the UK as refugees and stay here. In lots of other areas, we have longitudinal studies which follow cohorts over time and you understand the outcomes. We have, unless I get corrected, very little of that in the UK. That might help. Just one example of something that could help to mean that in 24 years' time, we might be having a better debate. Mm.
That is an optimistic note to end on. There will be a video and sound recording of this event available on the IFG website and YouTube shortly. There are drinks outside. The only thing left to do is to put our hands together for the sponsors, British Red Cross, but also the very, very excellent panel. Thank you so much.